Troy Dodds, and welcome to the On The Record podcast, presented by The Western Weekender. On this podcast, I'm joined by special guests who all have such great stories to tell about Penrith and the role they've played in our city. They are Penrith stories told by Penrith's people. Today, my special guest is David Trist. David has an extraordinary story to tell, a World War II veteran. He turned his experiences into a lifetime of helping others through legacy. At 98 years of age, David doesn't miss a beat in recounting what's been an incredible life. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Troy.
First question we always ask, where and where were you born and where'd you grow up?
I was a country boy. I was born at Tamora in 1925. My father was a World War I veteran and he left university to go away, and when he came back he went into teaching. And he was appointed at a very early age to Tamora, and then headmaster out at Wee Thalley, which is in the midst of the rough country out there. And I grew up in the Depression years in the western part of New South Wales.
And what was your childhood like?
It was very interesting looking back. My parents just used to let us roam around. Weekends, for example, four or five young kids up to the age of 10, we'd all have dogs, we'd get a bottle of water, and we'd come back at night time. We'd roam around the bush, catching rabbits and snakes and that sort of thing, and learning about life.
So you grew up in the country. When did Penrith and the surrounding areas first come into your life?
Yes, well, when the war finished, I had joined the Commonwealth Bank before I enlisted, and came back into the bank, and they sent me to St Mary's and to open a branch at St Mary's, or help open a branch. And of course, I married a local girl and moved away back into the country, then got a move back to Penrith as accountant of the Commonwealth Bank at Penrith in about 1956 or 7 or something.
Okay. You mentioned the war there, so obviously World War II breaks out in 1939. You would have been about 15 or 16 yes. at that time. So tell me what it was like in those early years. You're a teenager. Well,
at the end of 1941, when I got my leaving certificate, jobs were hard to get, but somehow or other I was taken into the bank and I was appointed to Queanbeyan, away from home in a boarding house, £100 a year salary. And I paid half of that to the boarding house for lodging. The war was going on. The landlady's son, for example, was taken a prisoner in Malaya. The young bloke whose place I took at the bank went into the 3rd Battalion he was killed on the Kokoda Trail not long after I took over from him. So the war was very... very close. Canberra Airport had a squadron of Dutch bombers who had escaped from Dutch East Indies, as it was, now Indonesia. And the RSL formed a unit called the VDC, the Volunteer Defence Corps. Mostly, nearly all World War I veterans. I was able to enlist with them for a couple of years to learn a bit about war. So by the time I was 18 and I enlisted and got approval from the employer to go on military leave, I was pretty well trained as a infantry person. Interestingly to me anyhow, I can remember the first couple of days I ended up lining up with about 40 other young recruits at Cowra. The sergeant major yelled out, "All those with previous experience, take a step forward." Three or four of us stepped forward, and the sergeant major looked me up and down and said, "And what did you do, son?" "Oh, I was in the VDC." "Oh, all right. You don't have to do the preliminary training." So I whipped through the early years of recruit training, and they sent me to a battalion in Sydney called the 18th Battalion. I thought, well, this is going to be good, but because we're not 19, we couldn't go overseas. And we were used as wharf labourers for about 6 or 7 months.
Right, so the rule was that you're 18, you can enlist, but you can't go overseas, yes. So you can't actually see a battle. Okay.
But anyhow, some of the other young blokes who stepped forward, one of them, the sergeant major, said, "And what did you do, son?" He said, "Oh, when I was 15, I went to Tobruk." He said, "And they found out my age and they sent me back."
Well, of course, that's a very common story, people lying about their age to be able to enlist. So at this point, you're 18 years old, you're enlisted in the army. How connected are you to what's happening overseas at the time?
We probably didn't keep very closely in touch with what was going on. We were more involved with route marches and drill and going to the pictures on Ackwilly, as we call it, AWL.
Yeah.
And but anyhow, a call came to go north, and the first job was jungle warfare training. In Queensland at Canungra, and then to a fighting battalion, and they allocated these young fellows to various battalions who had lost troops, casualties in the previous year or so up in the fighting. So three or four of us stuck together, and we went to the 58th, 59th Battalion, which was part of the 15th Infantry Brigade, quite a well-known in the army, as it was one of the few battalions that never lost a battle during World War II and was recognised accordingly. So off we went to the New Guinea area. My main memory of sailing away, it was on a Dutch ship of some sort, which wasn't very comfortable. But we used to gather on the deck, and I learnt to play bridge with a group of other young soldiers, and that stuck with me for the rest of life.
I think before that too, you were involved in response in regards to the Cowra breakout.
Yes.
For those who don't know, can you explain just what that is and your involvement in it?
Sure. The prisoner of war camp at Cowra had a lot of Japanese and Italian and German prisoners, and they were in different segments of the camp. And the Japanese decided to break out, and which they did, and there was a lot of slaughter. Some hundreds of Japanese escapees were killed. And we got a message in Sydney at our battalion to send down a few troops to help with the mess, and I was one of them. And we went down by train that night and arrived at Cowra, and there were still a lot of bodies and things around. And after about a fortnight, we'd rounded up everybody, and we had some trucks, wire cages on the back of these trays, and we put about 30 or 40 Japanese prisoners in each of the trays, and then a long convoy of maybe 40 or 50 of these trucks went out to Hay, where there was another prisoner of war camp. It was hot and dusty, no sealed roads basically, and we spent all day in the dust. We got to Hay at about 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock at night. It was still light, and the prisoners were put in behind the wire, and the guards, the Australian guards, one of them spoke Japanese. He told these prisoners, a group of them, maybe 200 or 300, that there was a white line inside the barbed wire. They weren't to cross that white line. They formed in a group and they rushed and stopped at the white line. We were watching from the sergeant's mess overlooking the camp. And they did this a few times, tempting the guards. And one of them got pushed over and he got shot. And that was the end of the stirring episode.
I know you had some issues with your health and skin and disease and things like that in your early days too.
The tropical diseases were prevalent, of course, and in a lot of cases, you know, we were advancing through Japanese areas, and for example, you might take over a Japanese position and you'd be in one of their trenches for 2 or 3 days and subject to the diseases that they had. So I carried skin diseases and internal diseases, parasitic things, for many, many years, yes.
You saw plenty of fighting, gunfire, grenades. Tell me about being in the middle of all of that and what your feeling is. Is it fear? Is it excitement in some ways? What's the feeling that you get?
Well, nobody can say they weren't frightened, but you overcame that normally. I remember on one occasion I felt a bit useless. We're out on a patrol, supposedly a reconnaissance patrol. We went to disturb or shoot people and make a noise. About to cross an open area, 4 or 5 yards of open area to a track. I was in front and got out in this open area, and then suddenly you could see a Japanese coming from the left, and I went down. I thought, I can't shoot him. Fortunately, I had people behind me in the jungle who were hidden. And I went down and hid behind what was about a blade of grass, and hoping he didn't see me. I was only 2 or 3 yards off the track, and he walked past, didn't see me. So, but I thought, how can I get my... I'd fallen on my rifle.
Yeah.
And I thought, I don't think I could shoot him or pull out the rifle without him then seeing me. So, you know, you've got to remember that you've got to protect yourself as well as hide yourself.
Mm.
And if you fall over, you've got to do it in a way where you've still got control of your rifle.
And you would have lost plenty of friends in this process. Yes, how difficult...
We lost about 200 killed in the last year of the war at Bougainville, which was very heavy fighting. And the Japanese there had a lot of artillery, and we were shelled, you know, quite frequently. Mm.
Tell me about the rather extraordinary story. You were put in charge of a Japanese soldier, and quite an incredible finish to all of this, and all topped off with a pack of the cigarettes.
Yes, well, it the story's been a bit distorted over the years, but we were advancing into Japanese territory as a company, and small patrols were being sent out. And I was on the third patrol of the day and pretty exhausted and getting near dark. And there were 5 of us, and we were told if we came across a Jap, try and capture him, bring him in. So we're wandering along the track carefully, and a little Japanese bloke was there, and he was shell-shocked, but he was alive. So we grabbed him, and then it was so dark that we decided we weren't going to try and get back to the camp, which was a couple of miles away. So we dug in. We usually dug in twos, and the corporal said, you and you, Trist, you and the Jap can go there, and you look after him during the night. So he was a fairly harmless little bloke, and I thought, I could handle this. And I had some wire, and I bound him up with wire, and dug a little trench and put him on the bottom of it, and then I stood on him. And I thought, that's a bit rough. And I start to talk to him in pidgin English, which I knew a bit of. And he wanted a cigarette, so I covered us with a gas cape, as we called them, to go over the top so the glow wouldn't go out. And he gave him a cigarette and got yabbering away to him in pidgin English. And the night went on, and I survived the night, but at dawn we were attacked. And things were getting a bit rough, and I thought, I'll get this bloke to yell out to his mates to surrender. So I said, Japan man, you call upon Japan man to surrender. And he stood up and he yabbered away. Oi, 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 they always start their conversation with, and things went quiet, and I thought, well, this is good. We're going to get a heap of prisoners here.
Yeah.
But the next thing, they're firing on us from the back. So he told them to work. We're all facing one way and to work. And at that time, right as it occurs in the pictures, one of our patrols turned up.
Right.
And
good timing.
A mate of mine was with on that patrol, and I handed the prisoner over to him, and I said he liked to smoke, so he got his cigarettes. He had a tin of tobacco, and So he gave it to him. And years later, maybe 50 years later, my mate Jack Payton said, "Drist, you still owe me a packet of smokes, mate." But I did get a souvenir and a banner. Returned that years later to the shrine, Shinto shrine up in Japan. And the chief priest sent me some cigarettes when he heard the story. And the brand of the cigarettes is Peace, P-E-A-C-E.
There you go.
Peace cigarettes.
And I guess part of that shows you the human element of all of this as well. Yeah, you're involved in a dreadful conflict. But at the end of the day, it's human beings involved here on both sides, all with families. So. It's... You know, that human element of war is tough to deal with, despite the fact that, you know, you're on opposite sides of a conflict.
Yes, the recent case of the VC winner being charged, it rang a chord with me, because when I went through my training, the bayonet training, for example, we're taught to be violent and vicious and cruel, and... the enemy were regarded as somebody you kill. And my first experience was with a case where a bloke was collecting gold teeth from an Australian, from wounded and dead Japanese with a bayonet.
Right.
And he had this big tin of gold teeth. He was going to make a fortune when he got back after the war, yeah. I reckon.
What was, for you, the most frightening moment during your time there?
Well, I can't say there was a particular moment, but advancing under shell fire, under a barrage of shells, the Japs firing at us and us firing at the Japs, and we're under all of this, and there's always a few short bursts, I think they call them, and you get sprayed with shrapnel.
Tell me about the day that you were listed, I think, in the papers as being killed.
The story about the attack on Sydney Harbour, you know, the midget submarine.
Yeah.
The Herald put out a casualty list the next day, or a couple of days later, and David Trist was in the middle of it.
Oh, really?
He was killed in an attack.
Yeah.
It turned out to be a young British sailor.
Right.
Who had been sent to Australia for rest, and there was no other accommodation but this little wooden boat down on the harbour. David Black Trist, his name. And he was killed. Years later, I had a phone call at night in St Mary's from a woman who said, my brother was killed in this submarine attack all those years ago, and I'm in Australia on a trip, and I want to take a photograph of his grave at Rookwood. So... I'll be going out in the morning and getting on the bus and going north and then back to Canada where I live. Oh, that was interesting. He said, "I saw your name in the paper, and you've got the same name as my dead brother." I said, "Yeah, I've been following that for years." So about a month later, the woman wrote to me from Canada. She said, "Look, those photographs didn't come out. Would you mind going out and taking a photograph of the grave?" So I took a couple of grandkids and sat beside there's 19 headstones in a row where the sailors were killed. And I got communicating with this lady and found out that this David Trist was about my age, and he'd been sunk twice. He was a boy sailor. The Royal Navy used to take them in at 14 or 15 or something, and rescued him. And then he got to a place and they said, you need to have a spell, go to Sydney. You can have a fortnight off or something. And the poor fellow got killed.
Yeah.
But he'd been a boxing champion in the Royal Navy, and you know, I developed quite a good history of him.
Yeah.
So that was interesting.
Incredible, yeah.
The
war comes to an end in 1945. Yeah. Tell me about how you heard about it ending.
Right.
Communication obviously is not at the levels that we experience today. Tell me about how you...
At the end of the war, there'd been a huge amount of rain in the last month, and the island we're on in Bougainville was very swampy, and there were feet of water everywhere, and we were basically living in water. And we had a tank... to support us, an old Matilda tank, and it had a wireless that could communicate with Australia, and we heard on that particular day of the atom bomb being dropped, and the war was over. So we were able to go back, and I went straight to hospital for about 6 weeks. And
okay, why was that? What?
Oh, I just covered with skin diseases.
Okay, yeah.
And could barely walk. And interestingly, I still remember after about a month in this hospital, there was a call for blood, donation of blood. I joined the queue, as I could walk at that stage, and I got up to this battle axe of a nursing sister, and she looked me up and down and she said, "Are you here to give or receive?" "Get away," she said. She wouldn't allow me to give any blood, but I still remember that.
So where do you return to? Post hospital, where do you return to?
Well, we went back to the battalion.
Yep.
And unfortunately, during our spell in action, which had been quite a few months, somehow or other they deducted money from our pay and bought bottles of beer.
Okay.
We had a LAB, a left out of battle unit, and they used to look after our gear back in the headquarters. And there were hundreds and hundreds of bottles of beers, and I had an allocation of, I think, about 18 bottles of beer that I'd actually paid for in this.
Yeah.
Anyhow, I got back to the unit, and it was gone. They'd drunk it. They reckon they couldn't afford to wait till I got out of hospital.
Drink your beer. What about your first meal back on Australian soil? Can you remember it?
We got back on a troop ship, and interesting, when we were going through the heads at dawn, all the troops on the ship, maybe 1,200, 1,500 of them, we lined up in the various decks and the passageways, and a message is used to come back. And one came back, "Watch it. There's provos as you get off, and they're searching everybody." And this message went right down the line. And as people got up close to the water, you could hear splashes. And those people were throwing guns and revolvers and swords into circular, number one circular quay it was, we'd pulled up. Mm. So the bed of the harbour there must be covered with... Anyhow, I wasn't going to throw the stuff that I had out. I got down and there were no provos. So somebody started this vicious rumour.
I think it was how do you get used to getting back to normality in that?
Well,
you know,
I went to, that night after we got back to Sydney, I went to a camp at Marrickville and they gave us leave. So I somehow or other got down to Sydney and I went to a barber in David Jones. And I sat in the chair and I said, "I haven't washed my hair for about 6 months. Give us a shampoo and a shave and give us the works, will you?"
Yeah.
Then I went to a cafe and I bought myself a steak.
That would have tasted pretty good after all that time.
Very good.
What I'm fascinated by really too is that at this time of your life, you're still in your early 20s, so you feel like you've had a real lifetime of experience being overseas and enlisting, but you're still in your early 20s. So really, this is now the next chapter of your life beginning.
Yes, it was interesting that you get back then, and I suppose we had matured, forced matured. For example, the first branch I went to after I got my discharge was at Parramatta. And there were probably 30 staff there, of which half of them were recently returned soldiers. Some of them were squadron leaders and, you know, 28-year-old pilots and so on. And we had to settle into the jobs of collecting the rubbish and jobs that were year before were well below what we were doing in the war.
Did you struggle to adjust?
Yeah, it took a while to adjust, and the 6 o'clock swill was on at the time, and Parramatta, I remember, these retired blokes knock off at, say, 5:30, straight to the pub and order 2 or 3 pints, you know, you probably 2. Drink them as quickly as possible, because at 6 o'clock you're thrown out of the pub.
Yeah.
So there was an alcoholism problem created. We were all subject to that at the time. Fortunately, I got over my problem, but then was appointed to come out to St Mary's.
And And so begins life in St. Mary's and Penrith, where you still are today.
I went to a boarding house in Melbourne Street and married the landlady's daughter and didn't pay rent from then on. So that was a great idea.
And what about family? What's, I guess, that chapter of your life begins?
Yes, well, out to the country with the bank and had children, three children, daughter followed by two sons, and... We had a great time travelling around small country branches such as Lockhart and Hay and Wagga and Bowral and then Penrith and then back to Wagga as a manager and then back to St Mary's as a manager.
So when you worked in Penrith, what era was that? What are we talking?
Probably 1956, 57.
Okay. But what does 1950s Penrith look like?
Well, of course, the branch was opposite the post office in High Street. Both buildings have been changed now. But Warragamba Dam was being built about the time, and the Commonwealth Bank was responsible for the pays. And one morning per week, I think about eight paymasters from the water board used to descend on us about 8 o'clock in the morning, and each one of them were responsible to pay, say, 500 people in cash. We had to have this huge amount of cash. The cash used to turn up the previous night at the post office in registered post. We had a couple of chaff bags that we'd go across to the post office, fill it up with this money. Each parcel had maybe £10,000 in it. And drag it across the street, no policeman or guard in sight, take it to the bank, unpack it all, and then we'd know what these paymasters wanted. They might want £200,000 or something.
Yeah.
And we'd have to make up this money, and they'd come in with all sorts of guards and things, and we'd hand over the Warragamba pays. And from 8 o'clock till, I think it was a 10 o'clock opening in those days. So... We're closely connected with that Warragamba development.
And Penrith itself, I guess, is still that country town vibe.
Yes, it was a country town. I bought a house at the corner of Stafford and Woodruff Street.
Okay, yeah.
Which still stands for £1,750. Wow. Quid. I didn't have much. I had to borrow most of that. And when I left a couple of years later, I sold it for £2,250. Mm. And I bought a new Holden with the difference with what I made.
Yeah.
So that's inflation.
Yeah, absolutely. You went out to Wagga, as you mentioned, then back to St Mary's. So St Mary's, I'm guessing, is 1960s.
St Mary's, of course, was growing through Mount Druitt's growth and residential growth around there. I was responsible for all of that area. And we started off with a staff of maybe 12 when I came back to it. And we built up to a staff of 140. And in our third building, we kept outgrowing the buildings and eventually built a two-storey one, which the council now have as their library. So there was a lot of growth in the district. I closely followed that. The branch, in association with Penrith and Blacktown branches, the three branches we... All very active, owned by the people, of course, in those days. It was before privatisation. And we were all trying to make a place for our bank in amongst the 12 or 14 private banks. And we were successful to get to the top eventually. And then it was privatised.
Yeah, so when does that happen? And
after I retired in 1985,
So you retire in 1985. Banking is still pretty, I guess you'd call it old school now, but starting to see that technological shift and credit cards becoming a big part. Bank card in those days, probably?
Yes. I saw the first lot of bank cards and the first ATMs.
Mm.
And the accounting machines in my time.
Do you remember the first ATM there?
I can tell you a story about that. I had a sub branch with an ATM. We had two ATMs in Queen Street, and they had two cartridges in them that you filled with £10 notes, $10 notes and $20 notes. We obviously didn't instruct the sub-branch very well because they put the $20 cartridge where the $10 cartridge should have been. And I got a call one morning, people are queuing up and they're making a fortune out of your ATM. So we had about 80 or 90 transactions that the ATM, which was one of the first, if not the first, put into the district. So it was an early one. And anyhow, we didn't lose much money in the end, but people were putting in $10 and they got 20, which was pretty good dividend.
Pretty good deal. Obviously, your connection to your war service doesn't leave you, and in fact, you become very involved with Legacy.
Yes.
So how did your involvement first come about?
When I was accountant at Penrith, a bloke named Jim Kinder was the only legatee. He'd been a prisoner of war in Italy, his own army, and he'd walked through Italy and Switzerland when he got out. And stone deaf, poor old Jim, but he was the secretary of the RSL and the employment service. I think he was the manager of that in Penrith. And he started up this Legacy group, and a number of us he asked to join. And so that was about 1958-59. Yeah.
And what is Legacy's main purpose? What do they try and do?
It basic and purely for the looking after the dependents of departed ex-servicemen. In those days, we had possibly 600 or 700 children in the district that we were looking after, and several hundred widows. And we made sure that the kids' teeth were okay and education was okay, particularly education. I had a family at St Mary's with a very bright young lady, and it was decided to give her some extra coaching just before the HSC in Sydney. So I had a new Holden, and I said, oh, I'll drive it down. So I got as far as Parramatta, in the middle of Parramatta Road, just after Parramatta, my new car stalled. About 5 o'clock, I had to be in Sydney by 5:30. What did I do? So I can still remember that. That young lady went on to become a headmistress of a high school.
Excellent, yeah.
And I still get Christmas cards from her.
Yeah. There you go. Because it would have been, obviously, particularly in those days, particularly in your, you know, post-World War II, just really difficult for those left behind to go on, really, and to have the same resources and things like that. You know, it was a very different era. So a tough time.
Yes. Yes. You know, somebody dies, they usually find that the widow hasn't been properly skilled in lifestyle, doesn't know how to draw money out of the bank. And an experienced person, you know, can act as a mentor.
And Legacy is still around today.
Yes,
it's
over 100 years now.
Yeah.
It was formed 1923, just after World War One, and it spread throughout Australia and then to London. It's still got thousands of dependents, Legacy widows and children. And in Penrith, I'm still on the list, but I don't have any family responsibility.
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, what about these days for you? 98 years old, as you proudly say, in your 99th year of life, as you like to put it. And you're still working.
Yeah.
What are you doing?
I'm chairman of a Cooperative Building Society, the Penrith Valley Co-op Housing Society, and I plan to be the oldest company director in Australia in a couple of years' time, I hope.
Yep.
I do know a fair bit about housing, having worked in a bank, and I'm very interested in affordable housing.
Mm.
I've got some ideas that could resolve the problems.
Yeah, well, housing obviously is a very pertinent issue at the moment, a really problematic issue for governments.
Yes.
What do you think should be done?
Well, I won't bore you too much, but you've got to analyse what makes up cost of housing, and you've got a number of segments. Land is the main segment, materials, labour, and fees. And can you reduce the cost of any of those segments? Land around these capital areas, there's a lot of land banking been going on for many years, and it's locked up. Yeah. The people who buy big chunks of land that are zoned can pay rates yet still make a profit because the capital gain just lifts it and they can afford to lock up these huge areas of land. So after World War II, the same situation applied, and a lot of government land was released by way of what they call suburban holdings. And I won't go into that, but it was balloted for, and it kept a break on the price of land. So how do we stop land, which was, in my day, £200 or £300, and now $600,000? So that's the main component in high cost. Then when you get to labour costs, if you can build it yourself, you can save maybe $50,000 to $100,000 for the house. Well, one of my old customers who migrated from Germany 50 odd years ago, Chris Nabus at Palkit Homes, had this remarkable engineering skill, and he designed an owner builder steel frame kit home that's still going. The family are running it at the moment, and I'm still interested in the company. And I say, a sense of achievement if you build your own house.
And I
want to expand that sense of achievement to gathering a group of unemployed kids, for example, or teach them how to build their own house. There are all sorts of opportunities like that. And government fees are one of the main cost components.
Sure.
In a house, when you put in GST and some of the other charges, you can get up to about 40% of the cost of a home. It's with government fees.
Yes.
So surely they can throw a bit in to reduce the cost.
It's certainly a
as well as competing very strongly with private industry. I know it'll hurt, but release a heap of serviced land at half the price, and everybody's got to bring down the cost of land.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a windmill that nobody will tilt against.
Talking of land and development, I know you've taken a particular interest in Western Sydney International Airport, which will open in 2026.
Yes.
Did you ever think you'd see the second airport finally be built? You've probably heard every possible story, cancellation, progress over your lifetime.
It's been a struggle. Back in about the 1980s, I was mixed up with the Council Development Committee, Penrith Council, and I was appointed as a delegate to the conferences on Badgerys Creek, together with the deputy town clerk. And the two of us used to go to conferences, and I hang on to all the paperwork kept an interest in it, and I could see that one of the main problems was the privatisation of Sydney Airport and a lot of the other airport. In that privatisation, an option was given to Sydney Airport to run the second airport. They had the option to run it.
Sure.
And I thought that would not be the right thing to do, and I had hundreds of letters to politicians and other people fighting against that, and eventually I didn't succeed, but it didn't go ahead. They didn't take up the option. So from that time on, I've had an interest in the airport. And recently, I was going to throw all my paperwork out, boxes of papers.
Yeah.
And my son-in-law contacted Sydney Airport, and a recently appointed public relations officer said he'd like to look through the papers, which I gave him. And he's been doing that in the last few weeks. And he's promised, when he finishes, to give them back to me. So
there's probably some fascinating pieces of history in all of that.
Well, there were a number of fights against the mayor of Penrith, who I thought the mayor at the time, I won't divulge names, and I had a bit of a battle. Mm-hmm. Penrith Council was subsidising a group of people who are anti-Badgerys Creek Airport, and I asked for a similar subsidy for the pro-Badgerys Creek, and they wouldn't give it to me.
Yeah.
So we're talking $20,000-$30,000, you know, in the annual budgets.
Yeah.
And they produced propaganda pamphlets and things which were against the airport. But anyhow,
time has passed, and I'm
very pleased to say I told you so.
Yeah, Penrith Council.
Penrith Council switched, and I seemed to be the only one in favour of the airport in the group I was with.
Yeah.
And they all were against because of the noise factors, which were unknown really at the time. And they were artificially created to the problem.
I want to ask you about, you know, you sit down now and watch the news at night, and you're obviously watching about the conflict in the Middle East, and you've obviously also seen many other wars happen over the years, from Vietnam to Australians serving in Afghanistan. What is your feeling when something like that unfolds? And, you know, does it bring back memories? Does it make you angry? Does it make you upset? Like, how do you feel as someone who has been there through that period?
Well, I'm certainly a pacifist to the nth degree now. And, you know, I know that there's no need to kill your fellow citizen to make your point. You should be able to discuss it. So there's always an ulterior reason for war. Prestige with leaders. They think that they can become world leaders by creating a warfare, but it's something we will never leave human beings, I suppose, but hopefully one day there'll be no warfare.
We can only hope. We can certainly only hope. You're still living at home?
Still living at home. I'm looking after my wife. I'm the chief cook and bottle washer.
Okay, yep.
I do get some domestic help from the Department of Veteran Affairs. Mm-hmm. And find it difficult sometimes to do my garden because I'm doing the washing or something.
Yeah.
But I was fortunate enough Channel 7 selected me to do my backyard, and it appeared on telly about 6 months ago.
Right, there you go.
So I've got a good crop of vegetables and flowers in the backyard. And I recently had a victory, which I'm very proud of myself, against the council's planning.
Yep.
There's a park behind me, and they got...
Whereabouts are you living?
Bennett Park in St Mary's. Yep. I live in Brock Avenue.
Yep.
And my house backs onto this Bennett Park.
Okay.
Which is quite close to the main street. Council advertised, and I saw a plan for the development of the park, and it was about the fifth plan they put ahead, and the others are far. And it included a huge skate park, and the illustrations of it, all you could see is concrete and bricks in the park instead of trees and shrubs.
Sure.
So I objected very strongly, and I asked for statistics on how many users of the skate park did they expect. As in Memory Road, there's a council skate park built a few years ago, and nobody used it.
Mm.
And there's another one coming up somewhere else. And, and the consultants that were being used were recognised as skate park experts, worldwide experts, who designed this new park.
Sure.
So obviously, they gave priority to their own thing. So I spoke and wrote letters, and finally they agreed, instead of this huge skate park, they'd break down the size of it about 6 months ago and just have a smaller one.
Yep.
I still objected, and I got a letter the other day that they're not going to have a skate park there.
There you go. You are obviously still pretty passionate about community happenings and what's happening around you.
Course.
That's something that's kept driving you as well?
Yes. I still walk down the street and old customers come and greet me.
Yeah.
And they assure me that I will always be remembered. So.
What do you think about Penrith and St Mary's today?
Well, we used to be deadly enemies, of course. In the very early days when I was young, football teams and the cricket teams, we used to fight each other. And we always, the amalgamation of St Mary's Council and Penrith Council, St Mary's were always the underdog. So I've supported St Mary's always, although I must, having lived in Penrith, I've got a soft spot for them.
Of course, yep.
So I feel, you know, with the airport opening and the railway coming through, that St Mary's will finally get a just reward, and it'll be a major area if you consider development as being worthwhile.
Yeah, well, because there has been a feeling that St Mary's has probably been, probably for the best part of 20 years, neglected almost. I know that our last two mayors, both Todd Carney and Tricia Hitchin, have spoken pretty passionately about...
They've been very good.
Yeah, revitalising that eastern part of the city. But there has been some neglect. There's no question about that. Yeah.
After I retired in 1985, one of my best areas of the banking was the Dunheved Business Park, mm-hmm. which I named, by the way. It was St Mary's Industrial Area.
Yeah, okay.
And I thought we needed a better name for it.
Yeah, wow.
You know, the 300 or 400 businesses there, I had a big percentage of those businesses, and I became a director of a number of the companies after I retired.
Mm.
But the Commonwealth Government, when they closed down that munition works just after World War II, handed it over to Penrith Council, who didn't have the financial resources to develop it properly. The roads were crook and too narrow, there was no master plan. So I had a committee called the Dunheved Business Park Development Committee, and we gathered together and for about 20 years or so helped bring about. We didn't complete the job. There's still a lot of work requires doing down there. But it was obvious that it was just an oversight. Yet it's one of the biggest industrial areas in the city and one of the most valuable ones, really. And I've been able to help recently Pacific National with their new huge development near the railway station.
Sure.
If something happens down there, often Penrith Council will ring me up and still ask for what I think about it.
Well, you've got plenty of experience. I guess people have asked you a lot over the years what your secret is, because we mentioned a couple of times you're 98, but you're very switched on. You're still very community involved. Is that the secret, though? Is it staying
involved
and passionate?
I do a lot of reading. At one stage, I was reading 3 newspapers a day.
Yeah.
But I don't like the politics of some of them, so I've cut them out.
Yep.
Don't do much book reading these days, although I have started up again with reading books.
Mm.
I think if you keep your mind active, your control over your body is better.
Yep.
And looking back, I had some notes here. Some of the interesting clients I had over
there. Yeah, absolutely. You would have worked with a lot of different people over the years.
Old Jack Lang. Do you remember
Jack
Lang? He was mixed up in the 1930s. Jack used to bank. I was accountant at Auburn.
Yep.
And Jack Lang lived at up towards Windsor Way somewhere. And about once a fortnight, I'd get this phone message. Mr. Lang is coming in. Would you please get his safe deposit box?
Yeah.
Which he had lodged with us. At Auburn was an underground strong room, so a fellow would go down with a trolley and pull this big metal box up, and I had an office up in the ground floor, and Jack had turned up, and I'd say, here, and then I'd walk out of my office, and he'd open the box. I don't know what he had in it. And then he'd put his head above the wave to me, and I got to know him. He's quite a nice old bloke. And he was a federal member of parliament, I think, at the time. And then David Coombe, who was the secretary of the ALP, was mixed up with that Russian business. He was one of my customers, an interesting bloke. Col Joy and Kevin Jacobson.
Okay, yeah, wow.
Were both clients. And Col Joy did the music at my farewell.
Really? Okay.
And he was a nice bloke. Except I gave him a housing loan for some leafy building down there. And a couple of months later, he was up a tree and he fell out of it and he broke his leg. And he blamed me for giving him birth.
Shouldn't have given you the loan.
Yeah. A lot of the Parramatta and Penrith footballers, I concentrated because the staff used to love Peter Sterling coming into the bank,
okay,
and, or Ray Price, you know, and they'd think, oh, we must be important. They've selected us as their bankers.
Yeah.
So the morale of the staff was part of that message. The Chinese doctors, I had maybe 40 or 50 young Chinese. The word got around that if you go to the St Mary's, you'll get a housing loan and a car finance and this and that. So they passed the message around and your business getting ability, you know, suddenly expanded.
Yeah, absolutely. And
the McDonald thing, you know, when the McDonald's opened up, I got one of the first McDonald's franchises. Okay. And from that, I had McDonald's at Goulburn and Broken Hill. And so it's a business getting thing. I was mixed up with the Mary Louise Petro at Mamre. I was on her board. And also on the Emmaus Village and then the Church of England. So I had the Catholic in the Church of England.
Yeah.
There was no Dick Smith, Ted Knopf's.
Okay, yep.
I was associated with those people with the Life Education Centre here.
Yeah, Dick Smith's golden era, obviously, of business. And,
Dick, in the Anzac Day marches, Dick always used to be in George Street at a certain spot, and as we marched along, he always used to have a banner, thank you.
Yeah.
This cardboard banner, as you might.
Yeah.
And I'd always break ranks and go, thanks, Dick. And we got to know each other. But he made a major contribution to the Life Education Centre at Colleton.
Yep.
Where I was the treasurer.
Yes, Healthy Harold.
Yeah.
That's when I was growing up, Healthy Harold was a big part of Life
that's
Education
Centre. Right. Yeah, well, it's still going.
Yeah.
And one night, as it was being built, Ted Knopf rang and said, there's a painting coming down Friday from Broken Hill. Would I mind taking delivery of it?
Mm.
And I had the key to the new building. I put it in there. And it turned out, I can't think of the name of the author, it turned up about 6 o'clock. And fortunately, I'd taken a mate of mine who was a shop fitter with me.
Yeah.
And I was just going to hang it up on the wall. You know, and it turned out it covered almost a whole wall, a big triptych. Have you ever been down there?
No, I haven't.
You go and have it's worth hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
And this donation by famous artist who's dead now, Ted Knopf's had arranged for a painting.
Yeah.
The bloke used to do dragonflies and very colourful thing, and it's in the vestibule as you go in the Life Education.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So we spent about 4 or 5 hours attaching this triptych through three big segments of painting.
Yeah, haven't been there since I was... In school, I guess.
Well, you better go down and have a look.
Yeah, better go have a look.
Yeah.
Just a fascinating life and so much that you've squeezed in there. And as you say, really fascinating people that you've dealt with.
Yes. And another thing that I've been mixed up with is photosynthesis.
Okay.
Carbon capture.
Yep.
And storage. And I've been interested in that for many years as I believe that... The answer is, and it's being worked on, of course, a replication of what plants do, capturing carbon dioxide.
Mm.
And in an engineering company as a director for many years, and I kept trying to get the people there to work out a machine that'll capture carbon from the air, as plants do, and convert it into useful products.
Yeah.
So that seems a simple thing to do, but in America the experimenting is going on, and it's probably, we'll be coming in about the time that oil and petrol disappear.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, an incredible life. The last question we always ask you, how would David Trist like to be remembered?
As an ordinary person.
Well, I'm going to say you're not that, because you've had an extraordinary life and an extraordinary story, and we appreciate you coming on and telling us more about it today, and all the best for the future, and a couple more fights with the council.
Thank you. It wasn't a fight, it was a debate.
A debate that you won. And I hope you enjoyed our chat with David. On the Record is produced by The Western Weekender. To hear future episodes, search Western Weekender wherever you listen to podcasts and make sure you hit subscribe. Check out westernweekender.com.au and we will see you next time.